And clearly, open source software has some benefits. From a licensing fee, $0. Quickly and easily adapted. I think the other aspects that I see happening in the education space are that educational institutions can actually work together, join forces, and contribute to the actual source code, or in the case of my organization, BC Campus, look to establish kind of shared services for hosting and support of Moodle. The other significant benefit, I think, with something like open source software is just that the end users end up actually contributing to and modifying and enhancing the actual source code over time, as opposed to a company's own employees. And there's lots of open source software in education. So Moodle's one example, but you know, there's Kaltura for video, there's WordPress for blogs, there's MediaWiki for wikis, and so on. And some of the others kind of along the bottom have to do with authentication and sign-on and the management of the whole identity associated with students and faculty. So that's open source software. One of the other open initiatives that we thought we'd throw out for consideration is open access research publishing. And this is really the impetus here is to encourage researchers to take the funding that they receive, which often is public funding, and the research work that they do, and publish that research work openly, so that you don't require the license of a journal in order to access that research work. It's openly available to the public, and anyone can get access to that research and utilize it. There's a couple of different ways of doing this, which I'm sure Terry will actually allude to in his talk, so I won't dwell on them, but you can either self-archive and self-publish your work so that it's freely accessible, or you can go to open access research journals that do make their work freely available. And Athabasca University, who's hosting this conference, has their own Athabasca University Press, which is an example of providing some of these works in an open way. And there are also lots of now web search engines that facilitate and provide a directory of open access journals. So for those of you that are faculty and are looking to include research articles and citations in your courses, you can actually start to utilize some of these open access journals to substantiate your coursework. The third open area is an interesting emerging area around open data. This is typically being led by government initiatives. The UK has been very big in the open government data area. My own province of British Columbia is now starting to establish itself in moving in this direction too. And essentially what this open government data aspect is all about is establishing a kind of policy and legal framework to open up publicly held information to the public. And there are a whole bunch of reasons for doing that. One of them is to look at the possibilities that affords in terms of creating innovation. It also, of course, makes government more transparent and more open. And the last reason for doing it that I quite like is to try to empower more civic engagement, to actually get more people involved in the democratic process. So there's a couple of examples of this that I'm just drawing on from what's been happening in BC. One is the city of Vancouver has been quite active in making some of its publicly gathered data open. And they actually launched a climate app contest for looking at and encouraging people to create climate action applications that use some of the public data that they've been gathering. The government of British Columbia at the provincial level has also established an open government initiative and a citizens engagement initiative and have even created an entire ministry for that purpose and have started to publish a lot of documents that are looking to establish different ways of working with the public and they're moving towards a kind of open publication of significant amounts of the data that they've been gathering on our behalf. And while this particular area of open isn't necessarily specific to education, I like to imagine what it might mean if we were to take the data that we all gather and utilize in our institutions and start making that open publicly to not only our own administration, but to students and parents and faculty elsewhere. And I think that the work that's happening around the learning and knowledge analytics, which I just did a quick screenshot of the course that George Stevens has been doing and just finished doing in Scope, I think that this is an exciting area where we'll be able to actually leverage a lot of the data and analytics that's being gathered within the education technologies that we're all using and begin to use them for teaching and learning purposes. Begin to actually start to take advantage of that data and figure out how to improve the educational experience of students through it. Open educational resources, the fourth area that we've been wanting to include in this discussion of all things open. This is an area I've been particularly involved in. This is where your learning materials, the coursework, and the courseware that you're creating for your courses becomes openly licensed for others to reuse, revise, remix, and redistribute. And this is a very exciting area, as I'm sure most of you are aware of different OER initiatives around the world. There's some that have been, what I would say, foundation funded by foundations like the Hewlett Foundation, or the Ford Foundation, or increasingly the Gates Foundation. So Connections, the Open Learn initiative at the UK Open University, and of course MIT's Open Courseware are examples of that. And following on that early work, which really pioneered the open educational resource space, we're seeing increasing public investments into OER initiatives too. So in British Columbia, the BC campus has an OER initiative that we've been running for about 8 years. But even in the Netherlands or in the UK, there are examples now of publicly funded open educational resource initiatives, which really are starting to make available a large amount of educational resources to all of us. And so it's interesting to imagine what that might mean as we start to move away from a phase in which education's been in short supply, especially at the content level, to where it's in plentiful supply. A couple of other derivatives around open educational resources. Open textbooks has become quite a hot space. Even here in Alberta, there's been some talk about looking at open textbooks as a way of reducing the textbook costs for students. So an open textbook would be one that, again, is openly licensed. It can be freely viewed and downloaded, modified by faculty and students. And so the extent to which you can defray the cost of a traditional textbook for using an open textbook is becoming a very interesting area of development. We're seeing lots of work done in this area in the States as well, Texas, California, and even Washington. The last area of open that I'll quickly touch on this morning before turning it over to my panel colleagues for more in-depth exploration of each of these is what I'll call open pedagogies. This is really perhaps the most new of these new areas, and it really looks at different ways of teaching and learning. And certainly massively open online courses, such as the one that Stephen's been involved with, or Jim Groom's DFS 106 on digital storytelling. These are courses that are being offered through established institutions and have tuition-paying students, but are also open enrollment supported in terms of allowing other people who are not actually enrolled for credit purposes to participate in the course and actively engage in the learning and with the other students. So these massive open online courses, another interesting example of an open pedagogy. I think, though, it's not the only example of open pedagogy, and certainly I've been speaking with Michael Strangelove, who's at the University of Ottawa in Ontario, and he teaches a whole bunch of courses related to culture and media, and he's made all of his courses open to the public, not to enroll and intake, but to be viewed and to interact, to have the public have the ability to interact directly with students. So it's moving kind of from a private closed educational model to an open public one, where the students' learning is actually publicly visible. Interestingly, too, from my point of view, Dr. Strangelove, that really is his name, has eliminated all written assignments from his coursework. No more written assignments. And instead, he has every student do a blog, and for their midterms or their final exams, they actually produce a video. Very different kind of model from the traditional written practice. I'll say just one other quick thing about this area. I think that the other aspect of this that I'm finding quite fascinating is that, for example, there is an open textbook being developed in the states in the area of chemistry, and students are encouraged to actually not only use that open textbook, but contribute to it. And if they contribute substantially important elements to the chemistry textbook, they actually get credit. So we're moving away from a model where faculty develop everything on their own in a kind of solo offering process to a more open offering process that could potentially even include student-created work. And the last one that I'll mention around open pedagogies is just the Open Educational Resource University. This is an initiative being led by Wayne McIntosh down in New Zealand. And it's essentially looking at what are the possibilities around taking some of these open elements, including open educational resources, and surrounding them with open assessment services, open student support, open methods for credentialing. It's really kind of trying to assemble a whole bunch of different open initiatives into a new form of an open educational resource university. It's really quite interesting. So this was picked by us as a theme for the Moodle MOOC, and what we'd like to do now is move into having the other panel members explore some of these areas of open in more detail. They're all very experienced and knowledgeable about these areas of open, and I think we'll have a lot more insight to share with you. And then once you've heard from the panel, we're actually going to move into a roundtable discussion format where we invite all of you to talk about these forms of open and to consider the possibilities.
Thanks, Paul. Gavin's next. Let me introduce Gavin Henrich, who has worked in training and development and using Moodle and other open source technologies, open source softwares and technologies for a number of years. He's also in the process of co-authoring a book on Moodle for Business. So he's going to talk to us about open source software and its underlying philosophies, practices, benefits, and challenges, and he's going to refer specifically to a variety of different technologies, open source software, and conclude, I think, with remarks on the synergistic potential of these open source softwares. So, Gavin, you're here from Ontario, I believe.
Yep.
Welcome to it.
Thank you.
I've worked with open source software on and off for about 10 years and benefited from it for an awful lot longer. So it's very interesting to actually talk about this. And one of the things is that open source software has very different uses and very different sort of business models around it. So these are just some of the open source software that I would be experienced with and use on an ongoing basis. We have Moodle, Mahara, which is an e-portfolio system. DSpace, which is used as a repository for open educational resources and open access. JasperSoft for business intelligence. Kaltura for videos. And of course, Alfresco's document management system. And one of the interesting things is all of these have completely different business models and sustainability plans behind them as a project. Don't expect you to read it all, but it's just there for people who are watching. And these are all the principles behind what is open source. And a lot of what was mentioned are in there. Access to source code, distribution of licensed derived works. And this is the constant theme within open source. It's this ability to constantly derive new works from the existence. And that's where the products actually keep on evolving. So what I started off doing, once I was asked to do this, I talked to about 20 different people within open source, you know, all those products I mentioned, both as a user, developer, and people who actually were used to them behind the management side, and asking them, well, what do you think of the philosophy behind open source, basically crowdsource this presentation? And this was a word that was created from those issues. But there were three themes that came across. The need for better software by allowing it to evolve and having more people created involved in creation. The software and community exist in an ecosystem. That's a really important one, because one of the things people come to me and say, can you recommend a piece of software in a certain area? One of the first criteria is, does it have a big enough community to actually still be here in a few years' time? And if you look at Moodle, one of its successes is that it's got this gigantic worldwide community, very active at all levels. And for open source software to ensure it derived works. And again, that's something where you've had different content management systems, you get Mambo, Gitlib, you have Joomla, you've got Drupal, you've all of these which may have similar elements. And then you've got someone in Sweden, for example, who creates a HTML editor, which is open source, but it's used by all of these others. So it's derived in its nature from that. Well, one of the things I'm going to do here is actually do some practical philosophy. How many people here have actually contributed to an open source project? Recommended anything? Can you just put your hands up? Okay. Well, obviously you can only just recommend and participate in forums, but what I'd like you to do is, if you're on Twitter, could you please tweet one idea that you would have for an improvement in Moodle? And it's something that we can just collect those together and pass them on to Martin as suggestions or put them in the forums for discussion. So just please tweet one idea, just try to tweet me sometime, of an improvement to Moodle. And this will be, if you have never participated, this will be your first step. And I do strongly urge you to participate, because it's you who make products better. It's everybody being part of this community, actively making this philosophy real, which is what makes the products good, and gives them a future. And the second part of that is about practices. Okay, and very much if you look here, it's about community. It's about profitability, technical side, it's about being open and having the source. And I think this is actually quite key. With all of which, the community again becomes very strong. And what does community give you? Well, as a developer, it enables peer review. So when a developer creates something, they put it out there and say, I recommend we add in this, any thoughts please? And both from a functional point of view, and so from the end users, and from a developer point of view, they will then peer review his work and see if it's suitable, and then someone like Martin will actually then decide whether it should sit in the core code or maybe just sit beside it as an extra module. So this, it does enable better and safer products. Why safer? Well, if more eyes are looking at all the code than, say, in a proprietary system, then security issues are identified earlier. And that's one of the key things as well. So it is perpetuating better products and safer products for us to use. So again, it's this crowdsourcing of security expertise, functional expertise, and user interface expertise. But the next one, the community is only a live community when it's growing. And that's key. So enabling new members that they can engage, learn, and contribute. And just like I challenge you now to tweet something, a suggestion for Moodle, it is important that if you go to Moodle.org, there's loads of forums there which you can find something that you can contribute on. The same with if you go to Drupal. Very active community, very welcoming. They run a lot of like Moodle things, they run DrupalCon. And then DSpace and other of these applications do the exact same. And that's the key. It is easy access. You can come in as a listener. And at some stage, if you have something to contribute, you can actually make that first step and say, you know what? I've got an idea. That's really powerful. It enables people to come in and keep the community alive and ongoing. and a willingness to share and collaborate. That willingness to share is one of the themes behind Open on All Initiatives. Over the last few years, I've worked in open source, open education resources, and open access, and it was constantly this theme that people are willing to share and actually work with other people as well. So, and find out what works and what doesn't, because you might have an idea which doesn't quite work in the way you think it would, but someone else might be able to make it work in a different way. So that type of collaboration is also really important too. So if we look here at this one, this is about the actual benefits. Okay, so of course code obviously, but then support. Why is support there? Well, one of the key issues is it enables you to have choice for services like support, hosting, training. Open source products enable you to be able to choose how you want to do. Do you want to do the training internally or provide support internally? You access the source code, so if you have the technical expertise, you can do so. And many institutions do. However, many institutions also look to organizations like Remote Learner to provide support for it when they don't have the technical expertise. But that's the crux of the matter. It's a choice. And it's your choice because you have access to the source code and are able to see what it does. And the first one there is choosing what the best product is. You can evaluate all of these open source products in the same area, like with content management systems, you have Mambo, Joomla, Drupal, WordPress, Moodle could be used that way, and many, many others. So you can actually choose which one suits your requirements, your needs, and your skill set. Do you want to go for a PHP application? Do you want to go for Python? If it's technical side, is it going to be a technical person updating? Is it going to be someone who only has basic web and Word skills? And you can choose the product which is right for your needs. And the open source aspect really helps facilitate that. But then also you're able to collaborate with other people. So if you have an idea, but you're not technical, you can put that idea out in a tweet, in a forum, collaborate on a wiki with people, and then maybe the developer says, you know what, I think that's a good idea. And an example of that actually happened this weekend at iNIC, which is another conference that was happening virtually over the last few days. With a discussion about the Moodle file system, and somebody made a comment about one aspect about not being able to easily replace a file in one scenario. And Tim Hunt, who happened to be on the session, went, you know what? I know a solution to that. Within a day, he put a post into Tracker with a possible solution for that. That was so someone who didn't have the technical skills, but was able to actually explain their need, someone else was able to collaborate with those skills. And that sharing and pooling of skills and knowledge, again, this type of collaboration probably for open source software is successful. And Moodle especially, being so global, benefits from this more than most. But don't get those benefits without some challenges. And that's what this slide is about. So people, projects, income, board, benefits, movement, sustainability. These are big issues. And it really does come down to here. So, firstly, if you are trying to become part of that community and want to contribute, you know, a certain skill set, you need to find a way to actually contribute to the project which you're interested in. Okay? So you need to see where you fit, where your skill set and where your knowledge and experience fit within that project and try and contribute that way. But the next one is, these open source projects, there's lots of them. There's lots of them which come, there's lots of them which go. And what makes you know one of those that is different is they have focused on sustainability. So it was the Moodle Partner Network who helps basically fund the development of Moodle through its clients. That is something which gives Moodle sustainability because developers constantly evolve new projects. With Google, it's very similar again. Donations or some work that's done in development work. Then you have Kaltura, Alfresco, SugarCRM. Many of these products have a commercial version as well, which is a hardened, maybe more tested, and a support contract-based solution. And I think this is key. If you don't have sustainability, then it is a business risk to adopt that piece of software. And organizations like this, the ones that you are representing, or like Athabasca, or any international corporate, they need to know that this bit of software is going to be here in 5 years, at least, probably. They need to know that there is commercial support, commercial development available. They need to know that it's supported enough that it's going to keep growing and not just stagnate. Because when people make a software choice, it's not a software choice for now, it's a software choice for the future. So, the OLGOF, which is an open learning group in Europe, basically, they've been trying to tie all of these concepts together. And for open educational resources, they've actually identified some of these key areas. But one of the very first ones is the availability of open source for the tools which are used by that resource. It's no good having an open educational resource, or less good, if it's a proprietary piece of software which is required to deliver it. Because in the open, it can't be reused, remixed, redistributed, unless you have that bit of software. Open APIs, that ability to integrate, again, driven by the open source ethos. And if we look at synergies, and sort of, and we've been going through there, we've looked at benefits, challenges. I think one of the interesting aspects is, where is open source used to facilitate these other open ideals? And I've worked quite a few projects in Europe, which you probably guessed from my accent, I'm not local. So in the open educational resources area, with DSpace and Fedora Commons, which are part of the DuraSpace project, I worked with the National Digital Learning Repository in Ireland. They have a DSpace with 20,000 licenses in it, an awful lot of downloads, where teachers in, I think it's something like 25 institutions, third level in Ireland, are actually sharing with each other learning resources that they have created. Similarly, in the UK, you have Joro, which does the exact same. And these are just two examples, but there's many around the world which are doing the exact same. For open access research, there's many different parts, including PKP. So with Tara, that's using DSpace for all of the research from Trinity College in Dublin, in Ireland. However, Rian was a very interesting one, because that's actually going a step further and collating all of that research for a national repository. So all of the third level institutions are then contributing into that. Then you have in Canada, Islandor, which is a Drupal and Fedora based solution. Again, for digital repositories, open access repositories, based over an UPI. And then, of course, Martin's taken, I think, the first step here in actually enabling a global sharing of learning resources and courses through the Moodle Community Hub, MOOC. And this is where people will be able to download or share the courses for download, or actually share the courses that people can enroll in them, so it's like advertiser courses that people can access your Moodle through them. I think that's a very powerful way forward. So, I'm not sure how I am on time, but thank you very much.
Thanks, Gavin. We are just a little ahead of time, so we're in good shape. At this point, I want to introduce Stephen Downs. Stephen probably doesn't need any introduction to this audience, but I thought I'd tell you that he works for the National Research Council of Canada, where he served as a senior researcher based in Moncton, New Brunswick, since 2001. He's affiliated with the Learning and Collaborative Technologies Group, the Institute for Information Technology, and, of course, specializes in the fields of online learning and so on, new media pedagogy. A popular speaker, a prolific writer, welcome to Edmonton, Stephen.
Thanks. And unusually for me, I don't have slides. I do have a computer and notes, and I have a mouse pad, but... And thanks for the welcome to Edmonton. I should say welcome back to Edmonton. I've spent many years in this city working with Athabasca University, working with the University of Alberta. Many years, debates, arguments, brawls with Terry Anderson and George Helens and the rest. I've been given the assignment from Paul Stacey to talk about, and let me quote, just so you understand what I was faced with on the day after an election, to talk about open government, data, and open pedagogies, including underlying philosophy, practices, benefits, and challenges with specific reference to NRC. And if I could have shot someone from across the country, I would have. I'm not going to talk too much specifically about NRC, and there were very good reasons for that. I don't want to be fired. No, I'm just kidding. But I do want to talk about the rest. And let me begin, because it's top of mind probably for everyone, about open government and open data. And I find it fascinating that the phrase open government is barely completed, and in the same breath we say open data, as though the two are the same thing. But let's talk about open data. One of the times I lived in Edmonton, I've lived here more than once, if you can believe it. I came back after I had left. I worked on a project called MuniMall, which was the creation of a learning information and research portal for the municipal sector here in Alberta. And it was one of the brainchilds of Terry Anderson. He recruited me from Assiniboine Community College in Manitoba, where I had been wreaking havoc for a number of years. And among the things that I was involved in MuniMall, and we did a whole bunch of things. We set up this portal. We set up this network of local government administrators. It's still there. It still exists to this day. They're even using the design. It's really, this is 1999 design. They're still using it. So I'm pretty pleased. One of the things I was trying to do, though, was to get access to data for municipal officials. And municipal officials are really big on maps. They love their maps. And they love their map data because it's so important to them, right? They need to know lots and property taxes, and therefore valuations, demographics, local income, skills inventories. They need to know things like where the pipes are, where the sewers are, where the power lines are, and all of that. And all of that is government information. It has to be known by government. It would be impossible to run a municipality, to run a government of any type, without that kind of data. And it's all available. And it's all known. So my thinking was, this would be a great thing to add to MuniMall, right? Every municipality could have its own map with all of its layers of data, and that's how these things are defined, actually, or designed, rather, as maps with layers of data. Well, it's 10 years, more than 10 years now later, as the era of Google Maps and Google Maps on the iPad, and my question is, where are our layers? Because we don't have them, do we? Right? Open up Google Map. Where's the sewer system? The technology exists. The technology has existed for years, and it's implemented in things like SimCity and other kinds of games. Right? So we know it's there. And there are all kinds of ways of representing this data, but it's not accessible to us. We don't have access to, you know, all the property lines in Google Maps. We don't have access to all the electrical lines. We have traffic sometimes if you're in the right geographic region of the world, which is, I think, not here. You know, there's this thing about open government, and there's some things happening here. And the story with the maps, of course, is the government sold the data to private companies. The private companies have marketed the data as commercial packages to real estate agents, construction companies, and, you know, basically enterprises that can afford it. And this is one of the conundrums that we face with respect to government data. And it's one that David Eves, and if you're not familiar with him and you're interested in government systems online, you should look him up. It's Eves, E-A-V-E-S .ca. I think it's davideves.ca, but it might just be eves.ca. And he makes the point, and it's a good point, it's a darn good point, this data is expensive to collect, it's expensive to store, and therefore it's expensive to distribute. And consequently, if there's a mechanism for distributing open data, there will always be this countervailing push, most recently realized in national elections, to somehow pay for that through the privatization and commercialization of that data. And this is a constant. The more expensive it is, the greater that push to commercialize is going to be, because people don't want to pay taxes. Open learning faces the same conundrum, right? If we think about it, the more expensive it is to provide learning systems, learning technology, etc., the more there is a countervailing push for the commercialization and privatization of learning. And we are in an era now, and we have been in an era for a number of years now. I remember my very first year at university in 1981, if you can believe it. And the first thing I did, year one, day one, I walked down to the student newspaper and volunteered. And my very first newspaper article with the gauntlet at the University of Calgary was $1.5 billion cut to education programs financing. And it was true, and they did cut it, and tuitions went up, and they've been going up ever since. Costs have gone up, and they've been going up ever since. And we have seen, correspondingly and not coincidentally, the push for commercialized online education, commercialized educational data, tools, and services. Right? Everyone's nodding because it's right. And it's not contra David Noble because of the technology. It's because of the cost. And one of the arguments that has characterized my career over the last 20 years is that technology is the answer to the cost, not the path to commercialization. But it's a hard argument to make. It's a hard argument to make because we are locked into a system that forces us toward these higher costs and therefore forces us toward the commercial. And that's an argument that this group needs to hear. So, let's think about open learning. Open learning is big for me, it's big for these guys, probably big for many of you. Almost certainly not all of you, which is an interesting thing. In a recent talk, the head of the Commonwealth of Learning, Sir John Daniel, he has a history in open education. He's former chancellor of the Open University. And so he has a strong background in the philosophy and in the field. Talked about the different phases of open learning. And he's quoting Taylor and revising it a bit, and that's okay. And the phases are as follows, and they are phases that have now become a standard fixture in discussions of open learning. The first phase is, well, there's even a pre-phase if you want to talk about open source technology, but when we're talking about learning specifically, the first phase is open educational resources. And then the second phase is the phase that we are now in and is characterized by experimentation such as being done by George Siemens and myself and others, open courses, open teaching. Be interesting. It'd be very interesting. I won't do it because it might be too interesting to contemplate. Well, it is dangerous. Well, look, you know what? Let me do it. How many of you are in institutions that charge tuition for access to classes, teaching, etc. Right. How many of you are not? Now, that's a better percentage than I would have expected, but it's a clear majority. Not 40% of you becomes a clear majority, but a clear majority are not yet into the realm of open teaching. The next phase becomes even more challenging. The next phase is open assessment. We don't even have models for that yet. Well, we do, sort of. There are, naturally, because this is one of the most expensive parts of education, there are already the commercial alternatives. Look up, for example, just to pick one out of the year, BrainBench, BrainBench. Fabulous site. But they're not the only ones. There are all kinds of sites out there now beginning to try to get into this market of commercialized assessment. And eventually there will be a countervailing open assessment trend. But so long as assessment remains expensive, there will be this push toward commercialization. And then there was the limit to which even Sir John Daniel would not go. It just was too much of an affront. And that is open credentialing. And I think that's a real challenge. We live in a system whereby credentials are granted by accredited and recognized agencies. And what happens if that breaks? Well, right now, I mean, the credential is practically the most expensive part of an education, especially in the internet age, right? You can get something like an education relatively inexpensively online, especially, you know, the TED Talks and iTunes University and the Khan Academy, so you can learn all about physics through YouTube. And, you know, with the different supports and the networks, there are Google groups and Yahoo groups devoted to everything. But try getting a BA, much less a PhD, without paying tens of thousands of dollars. It's not on. So, and Sir John Daniel is not prepared to go there. OERU, Open Education Resources University, is intended, in my opinion, to make very sure that that never happens. That the Open Educational Resources University will feed into the credentialing system and not become an alternative to it. So there are going to be some interesting discussions and debates about that. Open pedagogies. I'm supposed to talk about open pedagogies. Because somehow that's related. So, the system builder, had to build a way of relating it. There is a history of open pedagogies, and it probably, for our practical purposes, begins with Rob Koper, the Open University of the Netherlands, coming up with something called the Educational Modeling Language, which was snapped up and commercialized by IMS to become IMS Learning Design. Nonetheless, there is this standard out there in the world called learning design, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with. And there are even open source software packages like James Dalziel's LAMS, Learning Activity Management System, intended to implement learning design. Now, learning design is a very interesting thing, and the concept kind of makes sense, and it's a concept now that people like Diana Laurillard with Learning Patterns and Grania Canal with Open Pedagogies are running away with, and that is the identification and sharing of characteristic ways of teaching people. They are, though, there's always a but in my talks, right? It wouldn't be one of my talks without the but. And the concept is good. The concept, you know, they have their hearts in the right places. But what they are producing is a mechanism that creates some sort of process or flow or system of online learning, right? And if you think about it, if you just imagine an IMS LD in your mind. It can be done. It's okay. Right? You start here. Now we're imagining it, right? And in IMS LD, and in all of these, right, you start here. You start at the beginning. If it's LD, you have a role. So you are a serf. Okay. And then you go to the next thing, and the next thing depends on what happened previously and what your role is. So now you have a firm. Oh, wait, this isn't Farmville. Well, it sort of is. Right? And then there may be a decision point. You might do a quiz or an activity with the class, and at each one of these points, some sort of learning resource is presented to you. And if you fail, you loop. You do it again. Right? And basically, and if you analyze these things, the logic is exactly the same. It's a flowchart. Right? That's what it is. It's a pretty complex flowchart, and it's a flowchart designed in the worst of all possible programming languages, XML. And believe me, if you've tried to use XML as a programming language, you go back to something simple like Fortran, assembly language, stuff that makes sense. Process tends toward confluence. Process brings us together into a single stream. All right? This is what these pedagogies are. These pedagogies are the educational equivalent of centralized government. See? I can bring it together. But it's true. So, we've got two things happening here. First of all, because process centralized, because process brings us together, because process sets up these structures, it's expensive. Those of you who have worked with learning design know what I mean. It eats your time. It eats your resources. If you're just some person teaching and wanting to put something out there, even with a system like LAMS or some other learning design application, it's taking up your time. It's expensive to produce. It's even more expensive, trust me, to build learning management systems and other educational technology that can import these learning designs and actually do something with them, which is why we have so few of them and why the ones that we have aren't very widely used. So we have this convergence toward centralization, this convergence toward expensiveness, pushing us away from open education instead of toward it. So now the pivot point of the talk. I actually have the word pivot in my notes, in case I would forget the main point I'm trying to make, which has happened. If we want open data, we will probably have to create it for ourselves. Each one of us individually, not relying on some centralized process or agency to manage it and do it for us. Imagine if we tried to hire a company to develop Moodle and make it free of charge for everyone in the world. Right, let's try to hire Microsoft to do that. Right. Well, it's the same logic as imagining that we're going to depend on government to provide us with open data. Same logic exactly. If we want Moodle, we have to build it for ourselves. If we want open data, we have to build it for ourselves. If we want open government, we have to create it for ourselves. We cannot depend on government for open government. If we want open pedagogy, we have to create it for ourselves. And this ties directly into sustainability. I did a paper for OECD once on models of sustainable open educational resources, and I went through the list. And the list is pretty familiar with everybody who's been involved in this field. Right? There's the foundation model, where Hewlett or Bill Gates comes in with no agenda whatsoever and pays for your open educational resources.
That was sarcasm.
Or there's the government funding model, which works until there's a government that doesn't believe in the government funding model. That could never happen, could it? There's the subscription model, which in which case it's no longer open. There's the upselling model, in which case you're given something that is hobbled in some way and you have to pay extra for the full capacity of a thing. So I have an open radio software that I can broadcast web radio, but after 1 hour I'm broadcasting web radio with a overlaid over the top, which is the world's most annoying web radio. Really, really is. You try waking up in the middle of the night to that. And I had to because I was the only person listening to my radio station. And so on. And in that paper, I distinguished between two distinct models of open educational resources. The traditional publisher model, where you take authorities and experts, universities, publishers, foundations, etc., and you spend a lot of money and you build open educational resources and you distribute them to the masses, like manna from heaven. That's the model OECD adopted, hence the title of their final report, Giving Knowledge for Free. As though receiving open education was some sort of charitable gesture bestowed to us by the wealthy out of the goodness of their hearts. Or there's the prosumer model, which I don't really like the name of it, but there isn't really a better name for it, where the people who need open educational resources, where the people who use open educational resources are also the people who produce open educational resources. And you create a cycle. And if the issue, I said to OECD, is sustainability of open educational resources, then it follows almost necessarily that you adopt a prosumer model, because sooner or later the cost of producing them on the publisher model will push OERs to commercialization. Which is why there's this great big battle now about what kind of license there should be applied to open educational resources. And most of the people arguing at the UN level, the government level, the OECD level, are arguing that these things should be licensed for commercial use, because what they want to do is take OERs and create a commercial marketplace out of them. At which point, in my view, they are no longer open educational resources. We might as well just buy them from Pearson or McGraw-Hill or from Disney or McDonald's. So how does that play out in the world of open data? Well, we have models. RSS is a fabulous model. RSS was a way for each of us to publish our own open data about what's on our website, and to publish it in such a way that it can be aggregated and distributed and everybody can find out about it. Without RSS, I wouldn't be here, because none of you would have heard of me. Because, believe me, I'm not going to get distributed through regular channels. I've always regretted the fact that RSS didn't take off as a platform for other data. RSS stands for really simple syndication. I've always felt that there should be another type of RSS, really simple people, where each of us can distribute our own personal information for aggregation, distribution, etc. Really simple activities, so that we don't have to depend on Twitter to tell us or tell the world what we're doing. We just post it onto our RSA feed, and whoever's interested can aggregate that. Really simple organizations, really simple events, really simple learning, but we're not there yet, because there hasn't been this dedication toward open data as created by ourselves. Open government. What does open government look like if we do it for ourselves rather than have someone do it for us? You know, it comes back to this discussion of open government, open data, right? And people have always depicted open government as some kind of provision of services by the central authority, whether it be data services or whatever. But we want to move toward an environment where, in some way, shape, or form, we are able to govern ourselves. What will that look like? This is going to be one of the major tasks, I would say, of the next 20 to 30 years. Open pedagogy, again, not the process kind of thing, not the flow kind of thing, not a mechanism that describes how to teach us. Rather, what we want is some kind of mechanism that defines how we are able to learn for ourselves. Difficult problem. What would it look like? First pass, first approximation. Think of it as, and I don't even say it this way, I've written it this way, the specific skills, but I don't mean that. I mean the specific languages, I mean the specific pedagogies, I mean the specific technologies that provide the capacity to do the following. And I have a list of six items. I won't linger on it, but I do want to cover it. Pattern recognition. Mechanisms for seeing principles, mechanisms for seeing rules, laws of nature, similarities, metaphors, etc. Analytics, in another word. But not just, you know, not just aggregate analytics, not just things that add up the number of Facebook friends that you have, as though that's real data. But analytics that help you see regularities in the data, that help you know through a process of recognition. Two, mechanisms for, as the constructivists love to say, making meaning. Now, what does that mean? Again, that's hard. The traditional constructivist process is some sort of group formation, dialogue, negotiation, etc. I'm less interested in the process. All of those processes are kind of... But I'm interested in the intended outcome of such processes, the assigning of sense, the determination of a basis for truth, identification of coherence and consistency in sets of data or phenomena, setting of values, objectives, things of importance, assigning priorities, etc. What I would class all under the heading of the semantic. What are the tools? What are the pedagogies? What are the processes for that? Third, action, and especially action with tools. Capacities, affordances, ways of declaring, ways of interrogating, ways of warning, ways of directing, ways of suggesting, ways of building, ways of taking down. Fourth, situating and localizing. Ways of interpreting, translating, comprehending, being aware of one's environment, being aware of the multiple environments that you live in, being aware of context, who's around you, what does it do, what can it do to you. Recognition of alternatives. The meaning of the letter A is not simply in the letter A, but in the fact that there are 25 other letters that you could have used instead. Determination of value space. Logical space, root of Carnap, the logical space of possibilities. Of language. Fifth, I'm running out of fingers. Good thing I'm not on The Simpsons. Inference and discovery. Mechanisms that help us deduce. Tim Van Gelder built ages ago, like 10 years ago, a wonderful system that helped map out arguments. It was argument mapping, logic mapping, and it still exists. Hasn't been implemented anywhere in education that I know of, except in the work that he's doing. Why not? mechanisms for deduction, induction, explanation, tools that help us define, tools that help us describe. In other words, ways of knowing, ways of cognition. And then finally, sixth, pedagogies, tools, skills, languages of change. Sensibility to different types of change, ability to recognize patterns of change. We as a species have three bad tendencies. The first bad tendency is to think that things continue in a linear progression. What has happened in the past will continue to happen in the future. Second bad tendency is when we realize the first bad tendency doesn't apply, we think that things change exponentially. So if something is changing, it's going to go until it consumes everything. Twitter rules. Third tendency is once the first two don't apply, we tend to think that everything moves in cycles and what was will be again. And those are three theories of change, but they're three very simple theories of change, and we need better ways of being able to manage change, understand change. We need to be able to get at the processes of change, the assignment of values in change, the setting of variables in change, understanding, as Douglas Rushkoff writes, how to ride the wave of change. So these are the pedagogies of open learning, of open pedagogy, that might be thought of as a palette, affordances, toolboxes, whatever, pick your metaphor. So this kind of model, I think, is going to characterize the challenges that face us in the future when we are thinking about open government, when we are thinking about open learning, when we are thinking about open pedagogy. How do we map these pedagogies of open and distributed learning to systems that have been historically functionally designed toward a convergent process sort of environment? All of these will apply in the NRC as well. We're going to have big debates about them. Count on it. And I'm tying it into the NRC as well. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
And then you can have coffee, and then you can come back here, and we have some real interactive sessions. I'm sure you've got lots to discuss among yourselves already. But before that, let me introduce Dr. Terry Anderson, who is the professor, is a professor and Canada Research Chair in Distance Education here at Athabasca University. He's also the director of the Canadian Institute for Distance Education Research. Has been traveling around the world a lot, speaking in the last year, and is going to talk to us about open educational resources and open access publishing, partly based, I think, in the Athabasca context, but beyond that as well. And so, Terry, welcome.
Well, thank you all for giving me this time before your coffee break. I really do appreciate being able to speak in Edmonton because my carbon footprint is such these days that I can hardly find a pair of shoes that fits it from doing too much traveling. But one of the problems is, you know, I grew up in Calgary and used to say an expert is someone who's more than 50 miles away from home. And unfortunately, I am not that 50 miles away from home, so I hope you'll bear with me. And what I wanted to do was delve a little bit into some of the things that Paul noted. And, of course, I started an argument or two with Stephen, and I do all let you away for coffee. I'm going to talk generally what an open scholar is, and I know that everyone in this room probably doesn't define themselves as a scholar, but to me a scholar is some person who wants to take information, turn it into knowledge and wisdom, and make it accessible. And I think that every one of you has an inner scholar, and I hope that you'll think about that rather than if you're paid with that kind of a title that somebody gives you or when you're thinking about these slides. And this talk was inspired by Gideon Burton, who I've never met, but he blogs from Brigham Young University in Utah. And he wrote an article or a blog post, and he says, An open scholar is someone who makes their intellectual projects and processes digitally visible and who invites and encourages ongoing criticism of their work and secondary uses of any or all parts of it at any time. So you can see that open source stuff that Gavin was talking about, that, you know, the derivative products should also be a part of scholarship. And to make their scholarship not just available at the end, but as it evolves, so that you're openly transparent in what's happening. And I punched in Google definitions and talked about what does open mean. And all of these really resonated with me. And these aren't dictionary definitions. These are just the definitions that people have pushed up on the net. But, you know, things like, you know, unobstructed entrance and exit. I think that speaks to Stephen's notions, you know, that we need to, you know, make our education really accessible and not just, you know, pieces of it, but try to build it into a credentialing system as well. Affording free passes, open for viewing, accessible, assailable, loose, sort of aggregated of many parts put together, not tightly bound, and not brought to a conclusion. So open means convergent, that we're not there yet, that we've got lots of improvements, that Moodle is a wonderful learning management system, but learning management systems, as they are currently conceived, will likely not be around in 10 or 15 years. They will emerge, and they should emerge, into new structures that better fit us and our needs, and not sealed or having been unsealed. And this is a great shot of a very infamous wall, that this is the one that the Israelis built separating Palestine. And I like it for two reasons. One, because it reminded me of one of my favorite poems, Robert Frost, Something There Is That Doesn't Love a Wall and Wants It Down. And you see the graffiti of sort of this this longing for all of us to open up those walls and allow humans to exchange ideas and thoughts and not bullets. And ownership and openness is certainly not a new idea. Thomas Jefferson, in a letter to a friend, this is a very long quote, I don't know if I'll read it all, but that ideas should freely spread from one another over the globe for the moral and mutual instruction of man. I hope you'll forgive the sexist language, but for the improvement of their condition. And it's been designed by nature, it's sort of like open air, and it should be incapable of confinement or exclusive appropriation. Hmm. Inventions then cannot in nature be a subject of property. Now you know that that philosophy is not followed by, especially the Americans. They've got so much vested interest in copyright and in patent legislation that like patents at least, you know, it's for a limited period of time. Copyright just goes on 7 years after the death of the originator, which is absolutely ludicrous. And how, and it kept getting extended and longer. And Sonny Bono was quoted, what he wanted it to be was forever less a day. And that's the goal of the Americans. And there's been some WikiLeaks stuff coming out on how much pressure they've been putting on the Canadian government. And they tried three times and failed to get new copyright legislation. And now we've given them a conservative majority government. So I really think that we're going to have to be very active to ensure that educators' rights are free and are allowed to trump the commercial rights of copyright owners. There's an interesting idea about transparency, being able to see scholarship, to see students. And this really challenges our ideas of privacy, too. You know, like we've had the Freedom of Information Act here in Alberta, and I think there's similar ones across the country. And it really makes all of us cringe, and we all have to hire FOIP people to, you know, get mad at us and make us fill out reports and be our own police. You know, we have to hire these people to shut us down kind of thing. And it's given us a sense of fear, really, rather than a sense of transparency and openness. And Christian Delsgaard has got a great article in Rodel, the journal that Athabasca publishes, on transparency in education and online education. And I think that some of our PLEs, that people are developing personal learning environments, are opening that door to becoming more transparent. And the talk that John Grun didn't do yesterday, that Doris Siemens and me and myself had to filled in. We talked a lot about this idea of, how open should open should be, and how soft should the technology should be, and how hard they should be. And I think we're going to see an evolution and a fine-tuningness so we get a better idea of what should be open, what needs to be closed, and what really needs to be open in order to succeed and to have value for our students and for ourselves. Open scholars create a new type of educational work, maximizing learning media richness. And I think a lot of the kind of things, the 6 points that Stephen entered there, and we'll go in them at great length. And we heard from Paul about OERs. I think that it's amazing, actually. You ask your colleagues, how many of you it used to be you had to go to Merlot or go someplace or another, but now just doing a Google search, like, I wouldn't even think about developing a new unit or a new course without going on the net and grabbing some stuff and making it into my course. But so many of our colleagues, they just don't do that. And you wonder, well, why is it? And the reason I do it is because it saves time. And yet you ask student teachers, what's their biggest challenge in life, or why aren't they doing this or that? It's because they don't have time. And here's a way to save time. And it just doesn't seem to, like, we haven't got to that public awareness, I guess, yet. And so I think what we have to do in our staff rooms is be role models and sort of show people and take them on net safaris, because there's an amazing amount of stuff out there. And that's just to be a consumer, the first step. The next is to be a producer and actually be a contributor as well. So what do we need to get our institutions and ourselves? Infrastructure, of course, but that's becoming cheaper. Design. One of the things that Stephen was talking about was, this instructional design or other things like learning design that Rob Koper first developed. And the problem with it is it's a very formal, structured modeling language that was designed to be read and eaten up by machines. And that added a level of complexity that just isolated all real humans from it, or except for a very small portion of people who like to code in their spare time. So what I'm more interested is design patterns. And you're starting to see tools that come out in repositories that, just as Stephen says, talk about what is it about the ways that we know do effective learning in grade 2, in grade 8, in math, in science, and see if we can make those patterns available and easily adopted so that people can then just modify them for their own purposes and in their own systems, whether it be Moodle or in a face-to-face classroom. We need support, institutional policy, incentives, and licensing. Mostly, although we need experience, we just need to try to do a lot more OER stuff than we are. Is your script still in the room? No, he's gone. No, that's good. Because I've been really frustrated with that, asking, we have all our courses, why don't we put them out as open educational resources? And the reason is because we're afraid. We're afraid of it will change our model in too drastic a way. And we need a culture. And so many, I go to some of these open universities around the world. I was in one in Nigeria, and they were so proud to show me all of the courses and books that they had produced over the first 10 years of that university. That was their definition of themselves as scholars. And I wasn't in a position to evaluate the quality of those books, but I just bet that they're not any better or nor any worse than at open universities all around the world. So what have they really contributed? And instead of, localizing, making something real for their students, they've decided to be real scholars and write their own full packages. And it just is a dead end that we can't afford anymore. Why should we share our educational resources? Patrick McAndrew wrote a neat article where he talked about what did the Open University UK get out of it. Well, one thing, they got a few million pounds from the Hewlett Foundation, which unfortunately is not a sustainable model. But they said that it wasn't just, being nice guys and giving it away, altruism, but it was accelerated innovation around their whole universities. Certainly something we need at our shop, and I'm sure yours. Established partnerships through that process, attracted new students to the university, increased transparency, and it was great for their brand and their image. So all of those things go beyond just being altruistic. And many of you, probably your institutions have repositories where you're supposed to or you have the opportunity to put your content up there. And we had a big battle at Athabasca too. We run a DSpace OpenAU and tried to make it through our governing councils to make it compulsory for faculty members to put their content in that repository. We failed miserably. The academics, you know, didn't want to be told to do anything. And so it's now recommended. And so how many academics do you think actually put all their stuff out there? It's a little depressing, so I won't tell you. But let me ask you in this room, how many of you have an institution that has some kind of a repository that's accessible for you to put your institutional content out? Okay. Maybe a third. And how many of you have actually put something out? A few. Okay, well, that's a challenge for you. Go home, make sure your institution has such a thing. I mean, you don't have to be a university. You can be a college that has a report, you know. Just get it out there. Put it on the net. Make it so that Google Scholar or Google Engines will find it. And share that knowledge. It doesn't cost you anything. And it improves your contribution to the world and a return to the taxpayer, for that matter. Open Scholars apply the research to real issues. There's so much opportunity now to get involved in international work, to contribute outside of your local community and inside of your local community through the tools that the NAB enables. Open research is just starting to come, especially in science, where you keep your data in an open wiki or whatever, some kind of an open notebook that are specific tools designed for it. Because, you know, when I edit a journal and when we get these journal articles in, they all talk about it as if the way the project worked was just exactly the way it was planned. Everything fell into place and they got these wonderful results. Well, you know that just never happens. You know, that the ethics board refused them 3 times, MS survey system crashed, and all of these things happen. And all those learning experiences are denied people because the book is closed except for the very final results. And once you do get some data, there's a real movement now to put that data and make it available to everybody else, because they might have a whole new spin on it. And you've done all the work of collecting it, but that doesn't mean that data is finished doing its work. If you open it, other people can eat it up and use it for whatever they want. And this is just one example of a European project where they were looking at the impact of user-generated data, blogs, wikis, and other institutions. And they did, I think it was 256 universities, and they published their report, and then they just opened it up, say, anybody else want to see this? Do you want to duplicate it? Do you want to compare it to yours? Do you want to do an analysis on gender or some of the other variables? They weren't finished with it. Their time and money was over, but they moved it along for other people. Open the Scholars filter and share with others, and it's really nice to be able to publicly thank Stephen for filtering for me for years. You know, every working day I get an email, or it could be RSS, from Stephen, where he reads a lot more stuff than I do, and he filters it. You get a big piece of Stephen along with it, but it's a nice filter. So I would encourage you just to punch in the oil daily and get on that email list. And there's, of course, major blogs and all sorts of others. Open learning alternatives, Paul talked about that. The OER University of the People, Open Ed, peer-to-peer universities. We are seeing the emergence of these new models. And I think they have a tremendous opportunity. They're very threatening to some of our traditional institutions. So somehow we have to think about a way to gradually move our institutions and to allow them to pilot and to, you know, put one foot into it. Because if we don't, we're going to get blown away by some other system. It's almost inevitable that will happen sooner or later. And I want to make sure that it's public and open universities that survive in that new world. And unless we can start playing in the game and learning from it, we're going to be in trouble, I think. The whole thing of credentialing that Stephen mentioned, there is models going back, right back to the University of London in the 1850s and 60s, where they said, here is the test, the the syllabus of the things we're going to challenge or we're going to test you on if you want to get a degree from this university. We don't care how you learned it. We don't care if you hired a school to teach you. We don't care anything about that. We are a credentialing university, and we're going to give you a University of London bachelor degree if you can meet these standards. And that allowed people all over, especially the Commonwealth, but all over the world. There was little businesses that started out to give tuition to students on how to challenge this exam. And Athabasca is one of the few universities in Canada that has a system for challenging almost half or more than half of our undergraduate courses. If you don't want to get the package, you get assigned a tutor, you just want to write the challenge exam, you can do that. Unfortunately, that has two problems. One is we charge way too much money. It's like 60% of the cost of the whole tuition. And second, we have probably half of our faculty members who don't believe in that kind of thing. They think that that just is cutting out the university from a university education, and so we do definitely have things to learn about and collaborating and cooperating with some of these and creating new alternatives. We can know how to maximize their work. Of course, open source licensing has had a long history with it, and Lawrence Lessig and his partners at Creative Commons have done a wonderful service. If you're not familiar with Creative Commons, I do go there, and it's so easy. Like when I said you should put your stuff up for your institution, but go to the extra step of licensing it, and it's so easy. All you need to do is put Creative Commons somewhere it's reserved. They'll give you a link to put on your webpage. It'll tell all of the things that it can be used for and it cannot be used for. Because with this kind of licensing, you are not giving up your copyright. You're just making it accessible to others in ways that you want it to be accessible. And publishing in open access journals. I did a study with Olaf Zwacki-Richter from Germany. We looked at the 12 distance education journals. Coincidentally, six of them were open and six of them were closed. And we looked at every article over the past 8 years, and we tried to say how many citations, like how many people read that article and then cited it in a future article, which is the kind of the test for quality in an academic journal. And we could have hoped that we would find that open access journals were cited way more often. We know they're being downloaded and read way more often. We just hoped that they would also be cited. And unfortunately, we found no significant difference, which is maybe good or maybe bad, but it's partly because the closed ones are ones like the American Journal and the Australian Journal that are very famous, have been around for a long time, whereas the open models are much younger. And so we did see the trend of the open articles being cited more often. So that's my little plug. Please do go to Irodl, IRRODL.org, and get yourself a free subscription. And I guess we're about to make an application for the Social Sciences Humanities Research Funding, and one of the things that they look at is how many subscribers you have. So I hope that many of you will subscribe to Irodl. It doesn't cost you anything, and you will get about 4 emails a year with the table of contents of the journal articles. Scholars write and read open access books. Paul mentioned about AU Press. I'm editing a series on educational technologies, and we have 5, and George has got a book coming out, George Siemens, on PLEs very soon. There's 2 others that are in the works. So there will be, there are right now 5 full books, one on instructional design, one on mobile learning, one on teaching science at a distance, and the full text of all of these are available free. And on top of that, I have one of them right here, the one I wrote, and the person who's sitting closest to me who has a birthday today, can you put your hand up? There we go. Oh, happy birthday. Can I leave it here? The coming people have had a birthday this year already, or will have one in this year. You have all won one of these books. Just go to thepress.org and pick it up. And when we publish with the AU Press, that does not mean we get royalties. And this book has sold I guess I've written about 7 books. This is about the second bestseller, and I got a $600 royalty check last summer, and I'm waiting for this summer. So do feel free to, if you know it wasn't your birthday, that doesn't mean you can't buy a copy of this on Amazon. Or, and the other thing is all the bootleg libraries that are springing up now, you know, you can download it there, but please download it from AU Press and then we get it. We know how many people are downloading it. So, are you ready to take the pledge? I will no longer submit my work to closed publications nor participate in review or editorial functions for closed publications. Right from Simpsons. But, one of the real benefits of taking the pledge is that I get asked to do reviews for journal articles all the time, and I now just say, oh, closed, no, I can't do that, won't do that, and it gets a lot of work off my shoulders. So I encourage you, and then, of course, conversely, when it's an open one, then I feel a little guilty if I don't decide to review it. Open scholars comment on the works of others. There's Marginalia from Simon Fraser, Brain of Fine, other ones, where people are doing things like CiteUlike or any of the other ways that we can tag and add value to some resource by saying why it's a good resource or why it's a bad resource. You know, keeping that information locked in your own head is not being scholarly. And so you don't have to write a thing, but, and as Gavin said, you can contribute an idea to a project. It's really a useful way to build. Open Scholars Build Network, and I think of course of Scope and some of the other networks that are around. Open Scholars Lobby for Copyright Reform. This is from Switzerland. We've done it. Perfect copy protection that self-destructs after one play.
Yeah.
I think that's what the manufacturers and the publishers want, is something that cannot be shared and given away. Open textbooks, we've heard a little bit about. There's certainly Obama administration has put a big, I think it was $2 billion towards mostly at the community college level. For publishers who will publish in open access formats. So I think going to some of these, punch in open textbook, if you've got to assign a textbook to your class anyways, why not make it an open one? And the models, Flat World is interesting in the sense that students can buy it in paper or for a relatively cheap price, and you can get your own book published there, but you can download it for free. So students get to decide whether it's worth it or not for them to get it. And open readings as well. And then just ending on the fact that we have to help our students to become open scholars too. We have to show them what it's like, why they should develop a net presence, why they should put that book report up on the net. It isn't just so grandma can read it, it's so everyone can read and benefit from it. And the value of peer instruction is really, there's so many studies on how important it is to get students to review each other's work and comment on it and what a good learning technology capacity it is. But if you're in a small school or a closed classroom, you know, try to open it up to the world to review. Open courses we've heard a fair bit about. Of course, even in Georgia are famous for that. Support institutional and personal learning environments. This is, Stephen's got a product like this too, but this is edufeeder.org. And it's a tool I recently saw in Estonia, and it's a tool that's designed for you to teach in an open format. It aggregates blogs from all over, so the students own their stuff, and all this does is bring it together, allow you to register, do some of the functions. It's not anywhere near as powerful as Moodle, but it does allow that openness and that transparency in a formal or informal course. Open Scholars are change agents. I've been talking enough about that. Openness and the survival of public institutions. We often hear about things like University of Phoenix or any of the Capella universities or the private sector and how evil and how awful they are. But there is no credible evidence to suggest that the learning is inferior to what they get at public institutions. And that is a challenge. So what if private corporations were to go up to Stephen Harper tomorrow and say, look, we can do a better job. We will prove that we can do a better job, and we will charge you less money. But that's going to be a real threatening thing for us, and we see it in medicine and lots of other places. Openness is a way for institutions to give back and to say, we have value. We give more than just high-quality education. We're a part of our communities, and being open is a way to do that. Stephen mentioned producage. It's a term coined by an Australian, Axel Bruns. Got a very interesting book, but where the producers are the consumers are the producers, and vice versa. And finally, just a slide. It's probably hard to read, but what my vision anyway is for at the basket. You don't even read that on the screen, but the box in the middle, this Moodle on the left side, that's our closed world. We have to have some secure students. Need to have an option to be private if they want. As new teachers, we have our registrar, our library that has a lot of licensed things that we are not allowed to distribute all around the world. So there is a place in the world, in our world, and our institutions for a closed world. But what we're trying to do through the building of the L-based system in Athabasca Landing is give an open place or a semi-open place, a place where students and teachers decide what's open and what's closed. Their blog posts, their e-portfolios, their files, their bookmarks, all that sort of stuff. And where we give samples of our content if we can't give it all. And, people can read and discover this from the outside world without having to log into the Basque University. So thank you. Openness is a spiral of growth, but you have to start somewhere. And I hope that you'll go out and think about how you can be a more open person this afternoon. And at the end where I started with Gideon Burton, he says, open access is more than a new model for scholarly publishing. It is the only ethical move available to scholars who take their own work seriously enough to believe its value lies in how well it engages many publics and not just a few peers. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Terry. I want to describe to you briefly what you need to do when you've finished coffee. First, I want to say that the organizers need to shut down the wireless system at the coffee break. They will shut down the entire system and reboot, so I think it should be working better when you come back from coffee. Coffee is in the Rundle Room, as Brian mentioned earlier, which is to your right out the main doors here. When you come back, you can go straight through the back. Good, thanks. When you come back, we're going to ask the panel, at least three of the panel, to spread themselves out in the room to help facilitate the conversations at the various tables.
That could be heard.
Paul is going to facilitate the Illuminate session, the discussion in Illuminate. There will be sheets with questions on each of the tables, questions that address some of your own experiences with all things open in your own institutions, questions around how you're participating, giving you a chance to share with whoever you're sitting with. Hopefully you're sitting with somebody who's not from your institution, so there's a better cross-pollination of ideas. Things about the benefits and the challenges and what you know. We're going to give you about 20 minutes to have those conversations. We'll reconvene and get some feedback from you. Then we will go back and ask questions again, and then reconvene again after that. So there's a fair bit of interaction. The first set of questions is around open source software and open access research publishing and open government data. So those three elements of what we talked about this morning. And if you have any questions, come on up and ask, and enjoy your coffee. See you back here at 10:45. We will start.
That's great, Stephen. You were just doing that during the first talk?
Yeah.
Just in time, publishing, just in time, creation.
Yeah.
Pretty cool.
No slides,
though. What's that?
No slides, though. I've
had one of those. So you guys can hang around?
Yeah.
You can hang around?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, fantastic. So the idea is just find a table, sit there so people will convene around that, and you know, just get them to talk.
I'm sure they'll talk.
We've given them the structure of the question, so they don't want to do it.
Yeah, I think we've been reading this morning, where in Portugal, one of the governments are pushing to ban
creative it's actually a topic.
No way, really.
So they are outlawed creative, if they want to, they're all going to take all the payments for their work. I mean, can you imagine that? It's a communist or Marxist report.
Yes.
I was like, oh, wow, okay, that's nearly the opposite of socialism, isn't it?
Well, yeah, that's interesting.
I just thought that was... It was very appropriate for support.
Interesting how the borders between philosophies get permeable when practicality is there. Maybe there's a lobby from somebody who's publishing house doesn't necessarily have to know what's in the probably your wife should.
Yeah.
Oh dear. Okay.
But you should have known the guy.
Yeah.
So it was a very interesting presentation. Very interesting.
Yeah, I think so too. The combination before really came together in a way that
we could really. It was interesting to see people actually did speak.
Did they? Oh, I'm glad to see that.
But it was.
We were hoping, actually, I forgot to mention that at the tables they could be tweeting their questions as well.
There
you go.
Sorry, that's scary. I did it again.
No, you didn't do it the first time. This time you did it.
Okay.
The first time I did it. And then you stepped on it. Yeah, me too. 8:30 start.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Three courses, and then you get six courses, and you get a certificate, and then 11 courses, and you get a master's. It's just a way to start you along without making a full commitment. So, same courses, only they're packaged differently. It's an instructional design. Yeah, I mean, if that's useful for a specific employer, they move towards that, and you can see why you want a certificate, and then once you've had two or three years, you get a certificate, but that's also really helpful to get into the market. You'd be a known into the market, if you're successful.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Testing, 1, 2, 3. Testing.
All your time to be I could be a couple of questions, so that's one of the things.
Okay, we're ready to start. For those of you who aren't sitting at a table yet, if you could find a table, join a group, and get started on the conversation. The first conversation is around open source software and open access research publishing, open government data. The sheets on the tables look like this. And the idea is to have a conversation exploring the issues that are on that list. You have until 11:05, and then we'll call you back together and have you ask the panel questions. So we'll have the panel come back to the table and be here to answer your questions or to hear your feedback about what's going on in your own institutions, the challenges you're facing in the area of all things open. So go to it, and I'll call you back in a few minutes.
figure I should probably turn off the audio recording now.